fact is that since World War II, the U.S. dollar has been the reserve currency for all trade in the world. That's why we call it the almighty dollar.
We're not allowed to say that anything is a conspiracy, because if we do say it, we're supposed to be crazy and believe that in flying saucers and abduction by aliens.
Oppression is worse than death, so they're going to fight for their country.
There's some tension between the kind of neoconservative pipe dream of just walking into Baghdad on a bed of flowers and the judgment of professional military people.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, March 28, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. One missile struck a market in western Baghdad today, killing more than 50 people. Qatar-based Al Jazeera said 55 civilians were killed today at the market in a residential neighborhood. Footage showed the injured, many of them children, lying in hospital beds with their faces and heads wrapped in bandages. President Bush accusing Saddam Hussein's regime of committing scores of atrocities against the Iraqi people and prisoners of war said those responsible will be hunted relentlessly and judged severely, speaking to war veterans in the East Room of the White House. That's the president's version of how the war is going. Others see things differently. The Toronto Star is reporting not much is going according to plan in Iraq for the U.S. administration, and the pressure showed yesterday from an irritated President Bush and hunkered down defense secretary to a U.N. ambassador storming out of a meeting. The Philadelphia Inquirer is reporting today that 5 days into the war, the optimistic assumptions of the Pentagon's civilian war planners have yet to be realized. The risks of the campaign are becoming increasingly apparent, and some current and retired military officials are warning that there may be a mismatch between Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's strategy and the force he sent to carry it out. Bill Hartung is a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. He says the Bush administration has announced the war will be longer and more difficult as a public relations strategy.
You know, they seem to want to have it both ways because, you know, a year or so ago when they started beating the drums for this thing, a lot of the hangers-on in the administration, people like Richard Perle.
Who's gone now into
defense. Right. Well, he's not all the way gone. He's just not chair of the Defense Policy Board. He's still on the board. But he, anyway, he and his cohorts, who are very close to the Rumsfeld-Wolfowitz view of things, basically, we're saying, oh, you know, this thing is going to be, if not a cakewalk, certainly no great challenge to our military. You know, that getting rid of Saddam Hussein is going to be a matter of weeks.
But something has apparently gone wrong. I mean, well, we know that the Pentagon was banking on being able to bring troops in through Turkey in the north and attack from two sides. But when the deal with Turkey fell through, I don't know, I suppose they had to go to a plan B. Were they ever able to approach from two sides?
Well, you know, that's the other thing. I think not only did they miscalculate the strategic situation on the ground, but they miscalculated the global politics. They really thought they were going to get a deal to put 60,000 troops through Turkey. But not only did they not get that deal, but Turkey actually pulled back for a bit and said, not only can't we let you use the troops there, but we can't let you send cruise missiles over our airspace. And so there was a period of time where they were actually sort of even further behind in terms of Turkish cooperation than where they started out. So I think that's one major factor, that they couldn't invade the north. And now they've got complicated issues up there with the Iraqi Kurds, with the Turks, with the fundamentalist enclave up against the Iranian border, with Iranian arms going to pro-Iranian militias, with probably remnants of the Turkish PKK perhaps around. So to have to go up there with a 1,000 people at a time parachuting in, I think is puts them in a much more difficult spot, and it doesn't. It's not like they can just roll south to Baghdad. They've got serious issues to deal with up there.
And is that compromising their ability to actually fight the war in Baghdad? And
I think there's two elements. One is they don't have the Northern Front. It's sort of in name only at the moment. And the other is what General William Wallace said the other day, which was that, well, you know, in our war gaming, we acknowledged that there were these irregular forces, militias, and so forth, but we didn't realize they were going to fight. Mm-hmm. You know, so they're fighting. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, they've had to go back to some of the cities that they were going to bypass because, of course, what the these forces are doing is you've got this long supply line heading to Baghdad. They're waiting until it gets, you know, near them or past them and taking pot shots at it. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely, they're in a more complex circumstance than I think they expected
than they anticipated. In fact, they did. Not only did they expect that they weren't going to fight, I think many conservatives, neoconservatives, policymakers around this whole scenario expected that the people of Iraq, the Iraqis, would be throwing flowers at the feet of the soldiers.
Right.
And we've heard a lot of talk from the administration, and President Bush comes on television every other day threatening the Iraqi soldiers to surrender. And I don't know how many surrenders they've actually had documented at this point. Certainly there are some, but I don't think there's as many as they were anticipating.
No. The people... like Mr. Pearl, like John Bolton, who come out of the American Enterprise Institute and that other, all those other hard right think tanks, they had a plan going back some years to the Clinton era, where they thought this was going to be sort of like the Iraqi version of the Bay of Pigs, except our side would win. You know, you just drop in maybe a few special forces, maybe just arm the Iraqi opposition. And part of what took so long to get to this war, in the sense that Bush seems to have wanted to do it from day one, is the internal battles, because you had the neoconservatives saying, we can go light on the forces, we can use the Iraqi exiles, you know, it's going to be a cakewalk, as Ken Edelman said at some point, versus the professional military people saying, well, no, you know, I'm not going to send my people in there unless we've got overwhelming force, unless we are in a position to protect the people that we drop in behind Iraqi lines. And so they sort of half won the battle in that the Joint Chiefs got them to push the numbers up to, you know, 250,000, 300,000. If it was up to the neocons, they would have went in with much less. And even now you're hearing back and forth where some of the generals on the ground are saying, well, we still don't have the levels of forces we would like to see to be able to surround Baghdad and engage in a siege and so forth. And a lot of that, too, is political, because the Bush administration has been very reluctant to say how much this is going to cost, how long it's going to take, how long will the opposition, occupation take, and so forth. But virtually every time they have sort of lowballed it, they've been proven wrong. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious now, General Shinseki from the Army said in response to a question a few weeks ago that he thought it would take several hundred thousand troops for a number of years to secure Iraq in the post-Saddam Hussein period. Paul Wolfowitz immediately said, oh, that's wildly overstated. Rumsfeld made a similar point. However, Wolfowitz has never run a peacekeeping mission. Shinseki ran the mission in the Balkans. He's got some more relevant experience, mm-hmm. I might say. Mm-hmm. So I think even now there's some tension between the kind of neoconservative pipe dream of just, you know, walking into Baghdad on a bed of flowers, and the judgment of professional military people who realize that this is a whole different ballgame. This isn't just getting them out of Kuwait, where they're extended in the desert, where they've invaded another country. This is trying to drive them out of their own country. Mm-hmm. So obviously they're going to have all kinds of resources at their disposal in terms of knowing the terrain, in terms of knowing the people, to either outsmart, to coerce, to do whatever they need to do to make it difficult. That doesn't mean that Saddam Hussein is going to defeat the United States military, but at some point you have to say, what kind of victory is this going to be? Mm. I mean, if we lose large numbers of service people only to set up a regime that has to be kept in place you know, at the barrel of a gun for 5 or 10 years, I don't think that's really anything for George W. Bush to write home about.
There's a stretch of land that the troops have labeled Turkey Shoot in an article in today's Washington Post. Peter Baker writes, quote, the passage about 100 miles north of the Kuwaiti border has become perhaps the most treacherous few miles in Iraq. A contingent of about 120 Marines trying to make it to the first bridge Wednesday came under fire from assault weapons and rocket-propelled grenades. About 15 of their Humvees and 7-ton trucks were destroyed, and more than 60 of the Marines were wounded. They were Nasiriyah was supposed to be a six-hour fight, said Gunnery Sergeant Tracy Hale, who is a 32-year-old Marine from Philadelphia. So it seems as though the resistance has been much fiercer than they ever anticipated.
Yes, there's no question about that. And I think what the Bush people don't seem to understand is people can hate Saddam Hussein and still not want to be occupied by the United States. And so there's some people that are fighting because they support Hussein. There's some people are fighting because if Hussein goes down, they're going with him. There's some people who probably have a beef with Hussein, but they feel like, you know, just out of nationalist grounds, I'm not going to, you know, sit by while what they view as an occupying army is rolling through their country. So I think it's the politics of it are a lot more complicated than the Bush people expected. I have no doubt that there's many in Iraq who would say, yeah, if you can get rid of Hussein, limit the civilian casualties, get us a stable government at the end of it, you know, I could support that. But they've had a terrible history where the United States, both with respect to Iraq as a whole and the Kurds, has made certain promises during the first Gulf War, even back in the 70s, about supporting a liberation for the Iraqi people, and then pulling the rug out from under them when it didn't fit other elements of U.S. strategic interest. So I think there's undoubtedly a lot of mixed feelings among the average person in Iraq about whether getting rid of Hussein and replacing him with a U.S.-backed regime is an unmitigated blessing or not. But there's no question nobody's going to mourn Hussein's passing. But I think in the meantime, there's going to be some very difficult politics and some very difficult fighting ahead. And I think the troops would have been well served if instead of listening to the Richard Perles of the world, Secretary Rumsfeld had listened to the professional military people and the intelligence people, all of whom he has basically ignored at every step of the way. He ignored them when they said, we don't think Iraq would use weapons of mass destruction unless Hussein was about to go down and it was a last-ditch, desperate effort to do some damage. They didn't listen to him about the numbers of troops that the professional military thought would be necessary. They didn't listen to him about the idea that you really do need an international coalition, not just to beat Saddam Hussein, but to rebuild the country, to give any legitimacy to whatever efforts they undertake there. And so I think, you know, almost to a T, Rumsfeld and his inner circle have been completely politically tone deaf. And if anything, these professional military guys, some of whom are quite sophisticated in their understanding of the world, I think had a much more realistic view of what we're getting ourselves into here.
Bill Hartung, a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. Sonali Kalhatar of Pacifica Station KPFK spoke recently with Sosan Attar, an Iraqi-American with the Muslim Public Affairs Council, about her first reaction to the so-called liberation of Iraq and the resurgence of hate crimes in America. Attar says the war came as no surprise to many Iraqi-Americans.
We were basically waiting for it to happen because I think that most people knew that it was going to happen, even though we were hoping it wasn't. So I was actually driving in my car to pick up some food when I heard that the bombing had started. And it was really difficult because as much as I thought that I was prepared for the moment, we've been waiting for the day, like I said, it was just like, oh my God, it's actually started, it's actually here. And, you know, when you hear the word, you know, bombs are falling on Baghdad, and you know people in Baghdad, it's not just a place and it's not just a name. So, you know, it's very difficult. It's something you're familiar with. There are people there that you love. And so obviously it was hard. I was driving. I had to pull over and take a minute before I kept going.
Talk a little bit about any responses you have had from your family. Have you heard from them? And also here in the United States, how is the community, if you're able to summarize for our listeners, how is the community responding?
Well, the Iraqi community, I wouldn't say is divided in terms of the actual people, but I think in terms of their personal opinions, they're pretty divided in terms of what they think about this war. Some are pro-war, some are anti-war, some are pro and anti-war. I think
how's that?
Most Iraqis have very mixed feelings about this war because they don't support the regime of Saddam, but they don't want war. And so you know, I've heard from many, especially in the elder generation, we don't want this war. We don't want him, but it looks like we don't have a choice because this war is going to happen. So I think they're just trying to hope for the best. And definitely there are some people that are completely pro-war, and there are people who are completely anti-war, within families even. And I think that that's something that, to the credit of the Iraqi community, they can disagree within a family and be okay with each other, you know?
What about your family back in Iraq? How are they, have you been able to get in touch with anybody?
Yeah, actually, Wednesday when the bombing started, my mom got a call from her friend here in L.A. and who told her, you know, I just got through to my family, call your family and try to get through. And my mom, you know, all of our, basically, we just assumed that we couldn't get through for the past couple of days because they haven't been able to call out. They've only been able to send emails if they have access to it. So she tried and she got through. And she told me that, you know, she really didn't get to say much. She was just crying really heavily and telling them that she loved them and telling them that she hopes to hear their voice after this is all over. And they were crying and they were trying to comfort her. And it's so ironic because they want us to feel comfortable and not worry about them.
Now, with respect to what we've been hearing lately, the issue of, you know, we're in the sixth day of this war, and in my introduction, I was quoting some newspapers who were quoting in turn some U.S. troops, for example, or the British officer who said that this is not what we expected. We didn't expect Iraqis to resist us. As an Iraqi American, what is your response when you hear time and again Bush and Rumsfeld and others in every speech say, we are here to liberate the Iraqi people, and we're not here, we're not interested in occupation. They keep using the words, we don't have an ambition in Iraq. We're really here to liberate the Iraqi people.
Well, I just think that you have to understand the Iraqi people and their history and their, you know, personalities and their culture. And I, you know, they're very intelligent people with a rich history and a rich culture. And they generally have the attitude that you know, nobody can control me. Even though it's ironic because they do live in a very repressed society. But I think that, you know, maybe they even if somebody in Iraq has the perception that, you know, they don't like their own government, which most of them don't, you know, if not all.
They don't like their government.
Right. But at the same time, I think that a lot of them tend to see this as colonization as opposed to liberation. And, you know, I think a lot of them have the mentality that oppression is worse than death. So, you know, they're going to fight for their country. Of course, there are people who also, you know, surrender or, you know, don't involve themselves in battle. And I think that also has to do with the fact that if you saw the military, the power of our military in the U.S., you should probably just assume that you have no chance. But I guess some of them don't care.
Now, with respect to what Iraqi Americans have been going through in Southern California and in the rest of the country, have you been hearing anything? We've been seeing a few reports here and there. And in Michigan, there was a report of Iraqi American citizens being targeted by the FBI for suspicious behavior or anything, just basically interrogated. How has the Iraqi American community been targeted, if at all, here in Southern California? Do you know of anything that's going on?
I actually heard of two people I know. One woman called her family on Wednesday when the bombing began. She called her family in Baghdad. And the next day, the FBI came to their home. And, you know, wanted to ask her questions, but she said they were respectful. Mm-hmm. I mean, they asked her to ask questions, but she told them that she's not going to let them inside and they're going to have to wait until she calls her husband. And, you know, she wasn't comfortable being there by herself. So she called her husband and asked him to come down, you know, and then they just spoke to them outside. So, and then they left and nothing else happened. And another man I know, his brother was, they came to his house and asked him a few questions too. And I'm not sure what led them to him, but, you know, definitely for the woman, it was probably the call she made the night before.
Just making a phone call to her family because bombs were falling and probably. She was worried about them. What about the issue of hate crimes? Now, for example, up north in San Jose State, there was a very serious incident at the university, San Jose State University, with not just specifically targeted towards Iraqi Americans, but Muslims in general. There was a graffiti that appeared one day that said, "All Muslims will be shot on March 10th. Very, very fear, generated a lot of fear within the campus, and especially, of course, among students. Are you seeing, you work with the Muslim Public Affairs Council. In the work that you do there, what have you seen an increase in incidents or just attitudes or anything after this, since this war began last week?
I think attitudes, definitely the increase is definitely on one side very dramatic. In terms of hate crimes, there have been incidents and, you know, obviously just nationally there have been several. I don't know that, and we're hoping that it's not going to be severe and it's just, you know, pockets of ignorant people and not an actual, something you can actually categorize as backlash. That's what we're hoping for. You know, we're not hoping that it's going to be a repeat of 9/11, post 9/11, or post 1991. But I did talk to a youth group on Sunday. And I was talking to them about, you know, how they feel as Muslims. These were all ethnic groups, different ethnic groups, being in school and trying to talk about the war and, you know, if their positions are being, you know, marginalized. And a lot of them did say that when war is brought up in the classroom, somebody will say, "Kill them all," mm-hmm. and the whole class will cheer it on. And then the teacher will not address the issue. And, you know, one girl said that she, after a kid in her class said, "Kill them all," and everybody started going, "Yeah," she said, you know, "How can you say that?" And she tried to talk to them about it, and her teacher even turned on her. So, I mean, there's a lot of that going on, and that's concerning because, you know, especially kids in school, in high school and younger, it's probably very difficult for them right now. And the concern is that there's majority of the hate crimes are happening on school campuses, and they're the most underreported.
Sosana Tar, an Iraqi American with the Muslim Public Affairs Council, speaking with KPFK host Sonali Kolhatar. Thanks to Fidel Rodriguez for production assistance with that piece. 15,000 Egyptians demonstrated in Cairo today in the first anti-war demonstration authorized by President Hosni Mubarak in several months. Previous demonstrations in the Egyptian capital were strongly repressed by security forces, and hundreds of politicians, students, and peace activists are still detained by Egyptian security forces. Raphael Kraft reports from a protest following this morning's prayer in Cairo.
"We dedicate our blood and our souls to the people of Iraq," chant the demonstrators leaving Al-Azhar Islamic University in the old city of Cairo. No mentions of the Iraqi dictator are made in Egypt, and unlike the violently repressed demonstration that were held last week in Cairo, portraits of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak are now displayed. This time, the demonstration is sponsored by the ruling National Democratic Party, and nobody dares to criticize the stance taken by Egypt, one of Washington's closest allies in the region, on its position on the U.S.-led war on Iraq. Hani Megali, who heads the Middle East section of Human Rights Watch, explains the fate of those who dared to criticize the Egyptian regime last week.
"We heard that at that point hundreds of people seemed to have been detained. Not only were demonstrators arrested, onlookers and bystanders were detained, and also people were taken from their homes, you know, in the middle of the night or early in the morning. Very alarming and disturbing details of tortures. I mean, severe beatings with sticks on the soles of the feet, beatings that have led to, it seems, broken limbs. But also, in one or two cases, we've heard about the use of electricity."
"Why you kill the children? Why you kill the people in Iraq? But you don't kill the people in Israel? Israel has everything. We hate Bush. I hate Tony Blair. I hate Iran. Because they are very stupid men."
Critics of the United States and Israel are tolerated, although this man will be asked by undercover security agents to shut his mouth while the crowd is following his slogans.
"We hate. I hate.
The ruling National Democratic Party took measures to explain Egypt's position in support of the United States to the people, who show growing anger toward Washington. It issued a document insisting that U.S. President George W. Bush is making efforts to implement a peace plan for the Middle East that will pave the way for a Palestinian state by the year 2005. Some leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood took part in today's demonstration. Ahmed is a member of the Islamic organization that has kept a low profile over the past several years in voicing its opposition to the government.
We must respect the government. We must respect any political action, any peaceful action which lead to a withdrawal of these forces from the America. Yes, although the government, detentions and torture sometimes, but now we are in the crisis. We have to execute.
So you allow the 800 people that have been arrested and tortured last week?
In Egypt, there is something like this. But I hope that the government be peaceful with all the people, at least at these days.
The demonstration ended peacefully today. While anger was strong towards the U.S.-led war in Iraq, the Egyptian government was ultimately successful in its attempt to stifle criticism of Egypt's support for the U.S., For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Raphael Kraft in Cairo, Egypt.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to go to our website at www.pacifica.org and make a pledge on our secure website. That's www.pacifica.org if you'd like to support this type of programming. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.